Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
AIG CEO Ed Liddy had what you might call a lose-lose proposition on his hands today, talking to Congress about those bonuses. He tried to put it into perspective.
I know $165 million is a very large number. It's a very large number. In the context of $1.6 trillion and the money that's already been invested in us, we thought that was a good trade.
I'm not so sure, though, that Congress sees it that way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 18th of March. Good to have you with us. Today might have been the most high-profile hearing the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Capital Markets ever did have. But when you've got the guy at the center of the storm in the witness chair, that does tend to focus the mind. AIG CEO Ed Liddy did what he could, both to defend the bonuses and to dodge congressional anger. But away from the television cameras and political point scoring, there is still that matter of a multi-trillion dollar financial crisis to deal with. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports now on worries we're taking our eye off the ball.
Collectively, Americans have lost more than $6 trillion in housing wealth in 2 years, and more than $8 trillion in the stock markets. Our largest banks are teetering. And Dean Baker at the Center for Economic Policy Research says before this is over, we may need another stimulus package, plus more aid for banks.
Clearly, we're looking at a much bigger bailout than we've seen to date, and it could involve hundreds of billions and quite possibly over $1 trillion of the public's money.
But Simon Johnson at MIT says what happened over the weekend at AIG could make that impossible.
Good luck persuading Congress. I think it's over. I don't think there's any more money available for bailouts of any kind.
If Congress doesn't appropriate the money to save the banks, the Fed may have to print it, even if that means inflation.
My greatest fear is the consequence of that we get too much inflation now, that inflation runs out of control.
And it's not just the U.S. banking system that needs help.
This is a global crisis.
C. Fred Bergston at the Peterson Institute says it requires a global response. He says Europe and some other countries need to spend more on stimulus packages at home and then join with the U.S.
to provide lots of money for the International Monetary Fund to help rescue poorer countries who are themselves being clobbered by the crisis. That's very much in our interest.
Because developing countries account for half the global economy. But more foreign aid isn't likely to top Congress's to-do list. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
As Congress and the White House try to sort out the politics of the bailout, the Federal Reserve is doing all it can to get private companies to take federal dollars and use them to jumpstart the credit markets. In fact, tomorrow is the deadline for applications to the Fed's latest intervention, something called the $1 trillion TALF, or Temporary Asset-Backed Loan Facility. But the commotion over bonuses at AIG may have already scared some of those private investors away, as Marketplace Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
Let's start with TALF. It's a way for the government to kickstart lending to businesses and consumers. It depends on private investors borrowing money from the government and using it to buy debt, backed by credit cards, student loans, auto loans, and small businesses. Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, says there's already some investor trepidation.
Some of the customers that we talked to were planning to participate, and at least a couple of them have told me they've decided they'll wait until the second round, see how the first people are treated.
Lowe says they're worried lawmakers could change the terms of TALF and other programs retroactively by restricting compensation or demanding a share of the profits. He says the fear is that as it deals with AIG,
in the process of doing justice, the government is undermining respect for contracts and ultimately respect for law.
The same applies to the public-private partnership to buy up toxic assets. Robert Johnson managed a hedge fund run by billionaire George Soros and was chief economist with the Senate Banking Committee. He agrees the possibility of lawmakers meddling in their affairs has made potential investors nervous.
Well, it certainly might deter private sector participants. The question remains whether that is a healthy or an unhealthy development. In other words, if you were handing out candy from the public sector to the private sector, it's a good thing it's being stopped.
Unless, of course, that candy is the only thing that makes all this debt sweet enough to swallow. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
In other Fed news, no news on interest rates that the Fed controls, but as we suggested yesterday, Mr. Bernanke and the gang are going to buy up billions in long-term Treasury notes as a way to keep some other interest rates low. Desperate economic times call for desperate corporate measures, so General Electric is going to let it all hang out. GE Capital, that is GE's financing unit, was a huge moneymaker for the company as recently as a couple of years ago. Not so anymore, though, in light of the meltdown. Tomorrow, GE Capital is going to open its books as a way, it hopes, to build up some investor confidence. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
Bernie McGinn runs McGinn Investment Management in Virginia. He has more than 5% of his holdings in GE. So what's he expecting from tomorrow?
Well, I think what you want to find out from the opening the books is that you don't have any time bombs in there.
Meaning investments that could blow up in people's faces unexpectedly. In this case, mortgage-backed securities or Eastern European loans. McGinn says giving investors a peek at GE Capital's holdings is a good idea.
I think to the extent that they can open the door, let people look in, I would very much assume they wouldn't do it unless they thought that the outcome would be positive.
He says it can't hurt, but financial analyst Peter Cohen disagrees.
The big risk that they run is that they open up Pandora's box and they can't close it.
Cohen says investors at the meeting will have lots of questions, and GE Capital's chief financial officer had better be prepared to answer anything that might come up or else.
There's a real danger that he exposes some things about GE Capital that make people worry that there's bigger problems than they had thought before.
And that's the last thing the company wants. Cohen says that's unlikely to happen, provided executives have done their homework. But if one tricky question leads to another, the meeting could end up stoking investors' fears rather than their confidence. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Traders were in a sour mood until the Fed said it's going to keep interest rates low today. Then they turned things around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little bit of the fizz went out of Coca-Cola today. The company lost what could have been a big toehold in the Chinese market. Regulators in Beijing put the kibosh on Coke's plans to buy a Chinese juice company for $2.5 billion. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
In a way, Coke got lucky. Analysts say the multi-billion-dollar price tag on Chinese juice maker Hui Yuan was too high. But the broader implications are troubling for Coke and for other multinationals. Kirsty Nicholson is an antitrust lawyer for the British law firm Lovells.
This may be a message to international companies that it's going to be difficult for them to invest in these famous national Chinese companies.
The Chinese government invoked a new anti-monopoly law to reject Coke's bid, but analysts say the real reason was protectionism. Everyday Chinese and the Communist Party elite both disliked the idea of a popular juice brand being owned by Americans. Matthew Slaughter is a professor of international economics at Dartmouth. He says rising protectionism in China and elsewhere, including the U.S., could prolong the credit crunch.
Greater flows of foreign direct investment can be part of the way that the crisis resolves, in part because foreign direct investment tends to be patient, long-term investment across countries.
China rode foreign capital to its current heights, but that door is closing. Outside investment in China was down 21% last year and is falling even faster in 2009. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The Senate confirmed President Obama's nominee for trade representative today. Former Dallas Mayor Ron Kirk was approved 92-5. The president will need all the backing for his trade policies he can get his hands on because commentator David Frum says so far they don't get high marks.
President Obama already has wars on his hands in Iraq and Afghanistan. Does he really need to start a trade war with Mexico, too? Monday, Mexico announced its intent to raise tariffs on 90 U.S. products. Mexico is retaliating for a protectionist measure tucked into the omnibus spending bill President Obama signed last week. The measure shut down a pilot program to open U.S. highways to Mexican trucks. That program honors a commitment to Mexico under the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement. All Mexican trucks on U.S. highways must meet U.S. regulatory standards so there are no legitimate safety issues. The truck ban is plain protectionism. If Mexico litigates under NAFTA, it will surely win. But why litigate? We have immigration problems to solve together and energy resources to develop together. Above all, it is only by working together that we can hope to suppress the violent drug war that has taken 6,300 lives south of the border since last January. This violence increasingly reaches into American cities like Atlanta, Houston, and Phoenix. Phoenix now ranks second among the world's cities for most kidnappings, behind only first place Mexico City. The chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, Christina Romer, has detailed six lessons from the Great Depression. One of the six? Recovery must be global. Protectionism can only prolong misery. Yet already, the Obama administration is showing signs of a dangerous protectionist bias. The president's top trade official, Ron Kirk, says he intends to focus more on enforcement, which many fear is code for protectionist actions. Democrats compare today's economic crisis to the crash of 1929. President Obama's stimulus and other spending measures are advertised as solutions to avoid the mistakes that transformed the 1929 financial crisis into a global depression. But of course, the biggest mistake of all in the 1930s was the raising of barriers to world trade. And that's the mistake the Obama administration is in most danger of repeating.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You can send us your thoughts at our website. It's marketplace.org. If you bought a house or a car or got almost any other kind of loan in the past 5 or 10 years, there's a better than even chance that your debt was passed along like a hot potato. It was probably bundled up with other loans and sold to private investors as a mortgage-backed security or some other kind of bond. The name for that process of bundling and selling is securitization. It's gotten a lot of the blame for the mess we find ourselves in. And there is some question about whether it ought to be allowed to continue. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
The idea seemed watertight, but it's not the first time that trying to compartmentalize risk to keep it contained hasn't worked the way it was supposed to.
She can stay afloat with the first four compartments breached, but not five. Not five. The water will spill over the tops of the bulkheads from one to the next, back and back. There's no stopping it.
There are remarkable parallels between that scene from Titanic and the disaster that struck securitization. Packages of mortgages and other securities were sold to investors as an essentially unsinkable way to make steady returns. Since they were made up of a mix of loans, that was supposed to offset the risk from any that failed. The remaining good loans were supposed to keep the security or bond afloat and paying off. Maybe investors were too confused by the complexity to understand what they were getting into, or they just never imagined an economic iceberg might sink the whole thing.
But this ship can't sink.
I assure you, she can.
And she will. It is a mathematical certainty.
Think of it this way. It wasn't just subprime mortgages that went under. The economic spillover helped pull down other loans, even many of the supposedly higher quality ones that investors were led to believe were ironclad. Now they've abandoned ship, and since investors have stopped buying these bundled loans, banks have less money to turn around and lend around the world. But there are already plans to salvage the SS securitization, raise it from the bottom of the stormy credit sea, patch it up, and set sail.
There will come a time, there will come a day, when our industry will once again deliver the type of financial efficiencies on which modern society depends.
As I listened to Chairman Ralph DeLosio deliver that lofty vow in Las Vegas recently to his group, the American Securitization Forum, there was an obvious question. How does the industry ever hope to win back the trust of investors who now see this business as far too risky and impossibly complicated? Tom Deutsch has been at the forefront of the group's Project Restart. He says the focus is on providing investors with a lot more information on what's inside the loan packages they're buying so they can clearly understand the quality of those loans.
I think there was a whole lot of trusting in the former market of both the originators of the loans as well as a little too much trust that was put into the credit rating agencies. And institutional investors clearly have a mandate now that they have to do more of their own due diligence on these loans.
Big money investors need to see hard proof, he says, before they'll start buying again. And until they do and credit loosens up, he says borrowing money will cost more and fewer consumers will be able to get car loans, credit cards, and mortgages.
If securitization doesn't come back, American credit will look nothing like it has looked over the past 20 years, which is, I think, simply unsustainable.
It's a self-serving myth. If you talk to the industry that benefits from this, that's the story you're going to get.
That's Robert Kuttner, a senior fellow at the progressive think tank Demos. He argues that Americans had no trouble finding credit before the invention of what he calls these complicated schemes, and housing, car sales, and other businesses thrived without them for decades. All the idea did ultimately, he complains, is make the rich even richer.
The demand for these products was created. It was not as if there were people out there saying, please give us bonds based on mortgages that are sliced and diced into degree of risk and yield. The securitization gang took a fee at every step of the way. It was in their self-interest financially to make it as complicated as possible. And these are the last people in the world who have any credibility if they are now posing as reformers.
Kuttner says, if anything, securitization created too much easy credit. But even now, the industry's Tom Deutsch sees a place for certain kinds of the riskier loans that critics blame for triggering the economic mess.
Subprime loans are very good for the American economy. Those with impaired credit that have, say, lost a job and had to miss a few of their payments on their home, but then want to refinance, should that borrower not be able to get credit because they have a low credit score? Those are very good targeted borrowers.
That worries Robert Kuttner, who says it shows the need for what he calls radical simplification and heavy regulation of this industry. If we don't learn from past mistakes, he warns, we could find ourselves right back in the same, well, you get the picture.
Iceberg, right ahead!
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Coming up, making money from sustainability.
Given the large-scale nature of biofuels, there is a worry that some companies or some investors may grab the land and even displace people.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 90 points today. That's an advance of 1.25%, closed at 74.86. The NASDAQ gained 29 points, nearly 2%, ended at 14.91. The S&P 500 rose 16 points, just over 2%, finished the day at 794. The Fed's plan to buy long-term bonds for the first time in 40 years boosted the price of the 10-year T-note. Yields fell to 2.47%. That's a pretty big drop. The Fed's action also boosted financial stocks, while AIG chief Edward Liddy faced a grilling from lawmakers over bailout bonuses. Investors sent the stock more than 43% higher. Bank of America rose, closing up more than 22%. Word that IBM is considering a takeover of Sun Microsystems created a solar flare. Sun shares jumped nearly 79% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its Index of Leading Economic Indicators for February. A Senate Committee on Financial Institutions addresses current issues in deposit insurance. And a House Committee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development holds a hearing on livable communities. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The South by Southwest Music Festival gets going today down in Austin, Texas. But this probably isn't the best time ever to be looking to land a recording contract. Some of the big-name record labels have consolidated or closed up shop completely, and that's even before you throw the recession into the mix. That makes it hard to get paid to make music, or even to scrape together the money to make a record in the first place. Jill Sobule is one singer who has figured out a way to put out an album and finance it by herself, or more accurately, with the help of 500 or 600 of her biggest fans. Jill, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Where did this idea come from of trying to get your fans to support your album?
I think it was the thought of, after having been on two major records and then my last two major indie records, the companies went belly up. I thought, what am I going to do now? Do it on my own, except I didn't have any money. So I thought, I'm going to do the old patron system and I'm going to ask for my fans to donate and give me money. Although for goods and services, so.
What does that mean, for goods and services?
Well, I had different levels of donation, from the polished rock, which would be a free download, to different levels. One was, I'm going to write you a theme song or a house concert. I'll put you in the liner notes. And then I had all the way to weapons grade plutonium, which was $10,000, which I thought no one would ever do. It was kind of a joke that you get to sing on my record. And someone gave it to me.
Seriously?
Yeah, and she was great.
Did you worry about who would give? I mean, there was a chance that it could only have been, like, you know, your three best friends that gave money.
The whole idea, there was the fear that it could be completely humiliating, that it would be my mom and her Mahjong friends or something. So it took me completely by surprise, and I think it was just a little more than 6 weeks that I reached the goal. And really, I was shocked.
And I have it right. It's $85,000 that you raised, right?
Yeah, originally I stopped it at $75,000, but people kept giving, and I had to cut it off at some point.
All right, so now that you've got the money to make the album, and you're not with a major record label or even an indie label, now what do you do? Because one of the things that labels do for you is take care of promotion and getting you out on the road. What are you going to do?
Well, I've already recorded the record, and it comes out April, but so far I actually haven't written a song in like 3 months, because all I've been is a record company. So I've been trying to do everything that a record company does: distribution, marketing, hiring someone to do publicity. So it's a lot of work, but it's been really fun. And I also think that the artist directly going to the fan without a middleman, I think sometimes the people you pay to be the middleman, they don't do that great of a job. I think a radio person or someone would rather go directly to the artist. It seems we're better at it in a way.
Once this album hits the charts and you make $1 million on it, you get all that money, right?
Yes, I get all that money, but they and then I'll have to figure out what else I can give them. I mean, originally what I wanted to do was to figure out a way where everyone could have stocks in my PinkoRecords.com. But the way the laws are here for such a small business, it made it incredibly difficult. But next time, I still want to figure out how to do that.
So there will be a next time then?
Oh, there'll be a next time, and I'll come up with even better ideas to give.
Hey, Jill, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. And maybe you can sing on my record next time.
Yeah, I don't think actually you want to hear me sing, but I'm wondering if maybe before you go, you could sing something for us. Maybe Heroes.
Sure. Why are all our heroes so imperfect? Why do they always bring me down? Why are all our heroes so imperfect? Statue in the park has lost his crown.
You can download a song from Jill's new album and find a link to her website on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Biofuels are the hot topic in Brussels, Belgium today. Politicians, business leaders, and activists are talking about sustainability and whether producing biofuels displaces food production and so bumps up prices. There were riots in some poorer countries last year over exactly that. But given the worries over climate change, demand for biofuels is still pretty healthy, and investors from the U.S. and Europe are looking at Africa as a place to grow them. Marketplace's Gretchen Wilson reports now from Tanzania.
In the rural Kisarawe district, the woodland is dry, the soil sandy, and there's no water for miles.
Nobody really lives on the land. There's a few cashew trees, a few old mango trees.
Peter Auga is with a British company, Sun Biofuels. The firm wants to lease 30 square miles of this tough terrain to grow a drought-resistant plant called Jatropha. It'll turn the oil-rich Jatropha seeds into biodiesel. The company will get this land for 99 years. In return, local people will get schools, clinics, and roads. Farmers here have okayed the scheme, but doubts remain. Bureaucracy often means a long delay between the agreement and the promised benefits. Hamiz Baladi is the head of the village of Mtamba.
We're giving away our land, but we still don't know whether we'll benefit from the project. We're waiting for jobs.
Tanzania's at the heart of a new biofueled land rush in Africa. Foreign investors have already applied for 4% of the country's land. That'd be like the U.S. leasing out all of Nebraska and Kansas to overseas companies. Some Tanzanian officials are raising concerns. Ngosi Mwihava is with the Ministry of Energy and Minerals.
There is a worry that some companies or some investors may grab the land and even displace people.
Some critics go further. They say these deals are like colonialism, with wealthy outsiders using Africa's land and cheap labor force to grow cash crops. Then when global markets for those crops tank, so do local economies. Emmanuel Mvula is with the Land Rights Research and Resources Institute.
Like colonialism, which came as a solution for the crisis elsewhere, biofuels comes to us as a solution for a crisis which is not ours. It's not for us. It's for someone else. And when it collapses, we'll be back to square one.
But Western companies say local people can benefit from these deals. The U.S. firm Africa Biofuel plans to make biodiesel from the seeds of trees. It says the fuel will run generators and power cars right here in Tanzania. Christine Adamo is CEO.
We believe that the first part of creating a sustainable economy is to actually provide some source of affordable energy. And why not look to the agricultural base, which is so rich in Africa?
Like many biofuel investors, she says she can create good local jobs and a meaningful profit.
There's opportunity in Africa. There's opportunity to do good as well as to make money. And as an entrepreneur, that's good enough for me.
That's good enough for many African nations, too. Countries from Ghana to Mozambique are signing away vast tracts of land for biofuel development. But Tanzania's creating guidelines to make sure this isn't colonialism revisited. And right now, all new land deals are on hold. In Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, I don't know if Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis was watching the grilling that AIG's Ed Liddy got today, but he has clearly decided he does not want to find himself in a similar situation. Lewis says, barring what he calls an unexpected meltdown, the government will have the $45 billion it gave B of A back in the Treasury by next year. And I guess the folks at Fannie Mae didn't get the memo about bonuses from companies that got a government bailout, $611,000 to each of several key executives, that according to an SEC filing today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 90 points, 1 2/10%, closed at 7486. The Nasdaq climbed 29 points, nearly 2%, ended at 1491. The S&P 500 rose 16 points, just over 2%, finished the day at 794. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, and Jeff Peters engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, in the latest installment of our series, Working, a Smuggler in Afghanistan.
Ali Dowd will smuggle 20 to 60 people at a time on a two-week trek through the mountains to find an illegal crossing. He'll charge about $350 for the service, $300 of which go to bribes. Still, half the cost of a visa.
That is a smuggler of humans, by the way. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.